That's the husband and wife team of Stanley Turrentine on tenor sax and my favorite jazz organist, Shirley Scott, on organ with Deep Down Soul, Earl May on bass, and Graciela Oliphant on drums. It's from their 1964 album, Soul Shoutin'. This is Lead Stories. I'm Mutrice Lead. And we'll be talking about two things today. Hopefully we can get both of them done, but I'll give it a good try. We're talking about what's missing in D.C., not just young girls, but also hard truths. But first we'll be talking about killing and quitting, how a cop evades justice in New York City. On Sunday, his regular day off, Officer Richard Haste submitted his resignation from the New York Police Department ahead of a departmental recommendation that he be fired. Haste was the cop who, in 2012, chased 18-year-old Romarley Graham into his Bronx home, kicking down the door. He found Graham cowering in a bathroom. Haste then shot and killed Graham. Haste said Graham had a gun, but no gun was ever found. We're going to talk about this case today to start out our program because this is an example of how rogue cops end up on the force. Now, imagine this is 5 years from the incident. 5 years from this killing. He was able to make a living for 5 years as a police officer. How did that happen? And he was allowed the privilege of resigning like any other police officer would. Except he had killed this young man. And even the police department personnel, the people in charge of training, said he violated every single aspect of training procedures when he chased Romali Graham from the street. Graham was walking down the street on the same block where he lived. He was just walking down toward a corner store, it was said. And out of the blue, this chase begins. He didn't know what this was about, so he started running back to home with this police officer and two other officers in pursuit, in plain clothes. He ran up the stairs. He ran into his house where he lived with his grandmother. And he ran into the bathroom. And he was trying to just see if he can evade detection. The cop bursts down the door, finds him there in the bathroom, shoots him dead. And the explanation after this contentious shooting was that the cop says, this is Haste. Haste is saying that he thought Ramali Graham had a gun. Well, he was placed on modified duty. And 4 months, it took 4 months for him to be charged with manslaughter. And he pleaded not guilty. And the judge just threw out the indictment, saying there were technicalities with the indictment, and the indictment could not stand. So the judge, Stephen Barrett, threw out the indictment. The district attorney then proceeded to try a new indictment, convening another grand jury a year later. And that grand jury, for reasons we do not know, decided there was no evidence to bring not even a manslaughter charge against Haste. So all the while, he continued to work as a police officer, earning a living, although he had ended, by all accounts, this was not a shooting by the book, if you will. Well, we saw that there was a settlement, and you know where I'm going. There was a settlement in the case. In 2 years ago, in January, the family settled for $3.9 million. $2.95 million went to the Graham estate. Graham's brother received $500,000. His grandmother received $400,000. And his mother received $40,000. The higher amounts were paid out to those who were in the vicinity of the shooting or might have witnessed the shooting or were immediate members of the family who were present somewhere in the vicinity of the shooting at the time to compensate them for their grief and suffering. Okay. So this is how justice often works, especially in Black and Latino communities where police officers are involved in egregious acts of violence, including killing people. The man walks away. In the 5 years that he had after this, while they were pussyfooting around as to, well, what do we do? Do we charge him with something? Is there some way we could avoid it but make it look like we really want to pursue justice here? All of this fiddle-faddling took 5 years. And he earned his salary for 5 years. Being able, in those 5 years, posing a threat to all young Black and Latino men in the Bronx area where he patrolled. What brings him down is not a bona fide prosecution, because, as I said, there were two attempts, and both attempts were railroaded. They were just cast aside for, quote, technical problems. I've never heard of a technical problem that, even after two tries, just didn't work. And this is a case in which the officer, without nobody is disputing the fact that the officer killed this young man in his house for no good reason at all. He thought he had a gun. And therefore felt entitled to chase him from off the street. The young man runs for cover, runs back to home base. He runs back home. He thinks, well, okay, I'm a little bit safer now. The door is closed behind me. I'm just going to lay low here in the bathroom. Hopefully this thing will just blow over. The door is just bashed in, and next thing you know, there's this cop standing over him, pointing a gun at him and shooting him, and he's dead. All on the supposition, on the belief that he had a gun. Well, he's a young Black man. He's 18 years old. He's walking down the street. Obviously, he had to have a gun. Isn't that the requirement when you're a young Black man and 18 years old and walking down the street? It's because you have a gun. The wheels of justice took 5 years to nullify any official prosecution of this cop. But now they had a departmental hearing. This is the police department now policing itself. Does not have the force of law. Witnesses, his mother, Graham's mother, and brother and grandmother, they're not called to testify. This is purely an examination from the department's point of view as to whether the police officer acted within departmental guidelines at the time that he took this young man's life. It was the departmental hearing which concluded that he blew every single guideline relating to an incident like this. And it was only Friday, this past Friday, that they were going to tell him he will have to leave the force as of today. So that is why yesterday, Officer Richard Haste, on his day off and with nobody witnessing what he was about to do, tendered his resignation. So he sustains absolutely there's no blot on his record at all. And the city of New York And the police department have nothing to say about how this police officer in such an egregious killing was able to just walk away as if it never happened. That settlement that I talked to you about, that $3.9 million settlement, the officer doesn't have to pay a penny of that. That's the city. And actually, when I say that's the city, that's the taxpayers of the city of New York who will have to fork that money out. But there's no accountability. There's no responsibility. There's no admission of any responsibility at all. Neither on the part of the police department, certainly not on the part of Officer Haste, not on the part of the mayor. This is just one of those things. It's over and done with. Let's move on. Now, as you know, I have raised this question about settlements. And I've raised this question about settlements, especially in these kinds of cases where you have so much, there's so much contention. There's so many questions to be asked. In pursuit of justice, the family now is upset. They think, and I agree with them, that Officer Haste should have been made to pay some kind of a price prosecutorially for his action that resulted in the death of Romali Graham. But here is the question, and I've raised it many times. When these cases happen, the families, counseled by lawyers who of course, they want to have a big case. They want to score a big case. This is a big case. The lawyers are very much interested in a settlement. So they got their $3.9 million. They got their settlement. The lawyer got his cut. But the question still remains, there is no justice here. Where is the justice? There is no justice. Romali Graham is shot dead, and his killer is able to hide behind his badge and evade justice. They haven't been able to touch this guy. So now I'm saying that we have to begin to answer these questions about what is the priority? Of course, compensation is a part of what the law provides. The law provides compensation for victims of crimes like this. But I remind you, there hasn't been a trial here. There hasn't been a real trial here that officially pronounces the crime committed by this police officer, and therefore the price he ought to pay. This is not about the city selling out $3.9 million of taxpayer money. It is about whether this police officer pays the price for killing an innocent young man. And then we have the whole police establishment covering it up, aiding and abetting his avoidance of prosecution. We're supposed to be thankful that a departmental hearing, not a court trial, but a departmental hearing determined that procedurally he violated, you know, the rules as they pertain to chasing a subject, and under what circumstances would you be able as a cop to kill a young man? So this was taken totally off the table, any idea of a real prosecution of this cop. And that was facilitated by the New York Police Department and up to the mayor, the police commissioner, and up to the mayor. We just give the black folks, they'll be happy with $3.9 million. And in fact, after there was no outcry. Exactly the same thing with the Eric Garner case, the chokehold case, where no police officer yet has gone through the prosecutorial process. They said, oh, why don't you sit across the table and let's talk? What's your number? What would it take for you to shut up and go away? And we could just tie these loose ends up and bring these issues to an end. The same thing happened in Ferguson, Missouri. Settlement. I told you some months ago about the case in Louisiana. 13 families settled. And there is no justice to this day. So we have to step up our game, because we have a vested interest in the outcome of these cases like these. We have to insist when they occur that the families declare and commit to how far they are willing to go. Are you interested in justice, or are you pursuing a quick settlement? You're not going to get both, although the law does provide that you should get both, but it doesn't work out that way. But don't get mad. Don't get all out of sorts when you sit at the table and you agree to a settlement, and then you're surprised that that very act is interpreted as, in fact, a settlement, that you're okay, that we should all move on. Or are you committed to going the whole nine yards and insisting on the prosecution of these officers to the fullest extent of the law, and that they pay a price? Not maybe, but that they pay the price for these crimes. That, it seems to me, is your contribution. That is your way of honoring your family member's death. It's not about money. It's about justice. And we have to insist, we have to ask these questions every time it happens, when the families and their representatives want people to get out there in the hot sun and march, want people to make phone calls and want people to demonstrate and protest. No. You first must do your part. And you first must make public, make it known that you are committed not so much to a settlement, but you are committed to justice. The settlement is part of the law. But it is not the only part of the law that you should be proceeding with. No matter what your legal counsel tells you, they want a quick cut, and then they move on. If you want justice, it means that you're staying the course. And you're not compromising justice with a fast settlement because they dangle some money in front of you. Okay. I needed to say that because we're seeing this cycle repeat itself over and over again. And we have to make it clear that there will be a requirement for the public's input in a situation like this. Your job is to state clearly what you want to do. Don't tell people that you're after justice when in fact you're after a settlement. We'll take this break, and when we come back, I want to talk about what's missing in Washington, D.C., right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I am Utrece Lead. And last week, the week closed out rather startlingly. An Instagram report said that the headline said 14 girls are missing. 14 girls are missing, and pretty much nobody knows what's happening to them, what happened to them. And of course, not only that 14 girls are missing, but 14 girls were missing in one day. I myself noted it on Friday in my summary as a short introduction to the stories that people would usually remark upon. And that was the headline at the time. All these news organizations were reporting the dire situation in Washington, D.C., specifically as it relates to young Black and Latina girls missing. And in fact, the major media picked up on the story, and they reported that in 1 year, more than 500 young girls were missing. Bottom line, it was refuted, and I think convincingly so. The chief of police, the mayor, Mayor Muriel Bowser, and the chief of social services for Washington, D.C., all reported that, in fact, the number of missing people in Washington, D.C. went down, not up. And they credited this to a program that they began recently in making sure that they do everything possible to alert the community, the public, of anyone who has gone missing. So they put this program together, especially to get the word out. And it consisted of putting the picture of the person missing and the circumstances of the person's disappearance and so forth. And they had done about 20 of those in a recent week or two. Somehow it was interpreted that all of this happened on one day, and that was not true. It just was not true. So there was a great deal of alarm. Understandably, there was a great deal of alarm in the community and beyond Washington, D.C. People, you know, went back to the days of the Atlanta murders and so forth, where people were just disappearing. In Atlanta, it was young black boys disappearing. Almost 23 of them, or 27 of them, 23 of them, they were able to identify. So this memory was resurrected, and all over the nation, people were in a state of great panic about what is the meaning of this, and whether they had reason in their own respective communities to be afraid. I hope the Washington, D.C., they've done everything possible to calm people down and to explain what had happened, and that the Instagram report was inaccurate and sensationalized. People just needed to check the facts. That's all. And so, on the one hand, you have to commend the police officers, the police chief, the social service chief of Washington, D.C., the mayor of Washington, D.C., indicating in so many ways that this is not something that they're taking lightly. They have solved all missing persons reports except for 22, they said. And that is an extraordinarily high rate. It means that this is a priority item, and it has been a priority item. It happens that the Instagram report missed the mark here by misinterpreting the numbers and so forth. They didn't check, and it became a sensational story. That said, I think it also raises some questions that most communities are loath or reluctant to deal with as communities. Because what we're talking about here in terms of just sheer numbers of people who go missing every year, and what happens to them, especially younger people. Now, that seems to me to be a major story that needs to be pursued, not only about the disappearance of these young people and the alarming regularity of their disappearances, but what it is saying about our communities. What is going on in our communities? It is not about blaming the police, and the police should solve this, and the police should be on top of this, and the police should know and you know, get these children off the street and back to their homes. The question that occurs to me is, what kind of homes do we have in our communities that are causing such an incredible and alarming runaway situation? What is going on? Do we really have a handle on what is going on in our neighborhoods and the lives of these young people? Why are these numbers so high? It's not that the numbers are high, and, you know, the story so far is that the police are doing everything in their power. I'm saying, aside from that, we need to ask the right questions here. What is happening in our communities, right under our noses, well within our own control, that we don't have a handle on this? And this is a nationwide phenomenon. I've been looking at the statistics, and overwhelmingly, they say, disproportionately, Black and Latino children account for the larger percentage of people who just run away from home or just disappear. We need to ask why that is. Not so much, what, you know, are the police doing everything? No. The question is, what's going on in your house? What's going on in your house? That your children don't want to be with you. That your children are running away from you. That your children prefer to take their chances in the street rather than live with you. That's where the question lies for me. What is it saying about the state of our families, the state of our communities, the state of our neighborhoods? It says that there has been and continues to be an implosion. The family is under severe implosion. Things are really, really wrong. It's not a problem that the cops could solve. It's not a problem for the social workers to solve. It's not a problem for the teachers to solve and for the city administration and the state administration and the federal government to solve. Those are your children. That's your problem to solve. It is telling us a story. These figures aren't just statistics, you know, on a piece of paper. These statistics are telling us a very scary story. They're not confined to any one locality, but they do suggest that African Americans and Latinos are experiencing something so severe And yet, nobody's talking about it. And the problem is right at home. That's where the problem is. Sure, there are all kinds of reasons for why young people decide, and even older people. You know, the old story, somebody, you know, yeah, the husband or boyfriend says he's going down the block to get some cigarettes and you don't see him ever again. There are all kinds of stories for why people disappear. But surely, because this has been going on for so long, there ought to be a body of work available. I'm talking about clinical and scientific work available that would help us come to understand the uniqueness of this experience among African American and Latino young people in particular. They're disappearing. It is no comfort to say, well, my children are home every night and I've got control of my house. That is not the issue. I would hope that everybody has control. The issue is that there are way too many. When you look at the record, and you look at the record over time, you see a story of utter self-annihilation, destruction, anything that you could, you can't get very much good out of it. And you see the destruction of the future. Because disappearing now, for most of them, means a forfeiting of their future. And we are not seeing it. We're not engaged with the problem. We're not talking about it. We talk about it as a news story. I'm talking about it as life. We're witnessing the destruction of life. And we could never, ever hope to discuss our collective survival if we're seeing our collective destruction in our young people. Why is it happening? How can we prevent it? What is the conversation that needs to be had immediately? The conversation is not about whether the police can go out and get my child and bring her back to me. That's not the conversation. It's not the police's job. What I'm talking about is not the police's job. It's not City Hall's job. It's in your house. And we are quick to comment about, my God, look, this is what they're doing. Look at them on this, and they, you know, they're over here. They're not paying attention to their education. They, all the negatives you could think about. And the one thing that we do not discuss is how we aid and abet the situation. What are the forces that are being exerted in our households, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, that are causing this horrible effect? That's the conversation we need to be having right about now. Well, I still say that we have to be thankful, at least that in Washington, D.C., we see an effort, if only from the point of view of safety. They made an effort to publicize, you know, people who go missing, to be very energetic about finding these young people. The statistics that they have cited sound very encouraging in terms of a success rate in finding young people and bringing them back home. So we ought to be a bit thankful for that. We don't see that level of response often, especially in African American and Latino communities, where we have such an aggressive effort being made to, you know, set things right. But ultimately, it is not their job. The thing that is wrong can't be fixed by them. This is not a job for law enforcement. This is not a job for the police chief and the mayor and the chief of social services of Washington, D.C. That's not their job. What is wrong, they can't fix. The fix is in the home. The fix is right there in the house. The problem is there. The fix is there. Of course, you'll have people, you know, basically doing their own thing. But that's not the majority of people. That is not the majority of people, young or old. So this story should sound an alarm to us, especially those in the African American and Latino communities, that we really better get a grip. There are many people I know who don't know their children. They don't have a clue. They wake up in the morning, they see them there, and God willing, they'll see them in the evening. And that's as much as it takes for rearing a child. They're not involved. They're not involved. And this is not about blaming people, okay? I recognize that people are working under extreme pressure right now. But I also have a historical comparison, and I see where even in times of slavery, utter concern was paid to the children. They knew what was going on with their kids. They were involved. If only to teach them what they needed to know to survive. That has not changed in all these hundreds of years. The involvement in the home is the ammunition for many of them to survive. We got to get this thing looked at, and we have to knuckle down. Whether you have children or not, we have to recognize that this is a crisis. It's a national crisis. And we still refuse to see it for what it is. It is telling us that our structure is crumbling. And it is the one thing that would save us, which is a strong family, a nuclear family and an extended family. A community family. Well, I thought I would make these notations, and we didn't have time today. I'm sorry for phone calls, and I see many of you are ready to engage. Perhaps we can do that tomorrow. You know, I don't get excited if we don't get the phone calls in on time. I would love to be able to, you know, to bounce ideas off of you, and you can bounce ideas off of me. But if it doesn't happen today, it will happen tomorrow. So we need not despair. I want to thank you so much for allowing me some time to stretch out and say my piece on these two things, because, of course, I'm not talking about these incidents specifically and leaving it at that. I'm citing these problems, I'm citing these cases as a way of extending the argument, getting you to see the broader implications. Because these two subjects that we talked about today, there are broader implications, and they're happening every single day. We can't afford to ignore them, nor can we certainly, we can't afford to ignore the consequences of them. So thank you so much for allowing me to do that today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. A really great program. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about the program. I also want to let you know that there are a couple of things I'm going to be doing, a couple of specials. We've been doing some research, and it's about time to just put them into a nice series of programs now. We have enough information to go forward with them on that level, and I'll be doing that. And I also want to say thank you so much. I've gotten so many messages, encouraging messages, and I want you to know, I can't type too fast now because it's my right arm and hand that are smashed, and becoming an instant lefty is not working too well. But your continued notes of encouragement and so forth are very, very dear to me, and they energize me and keep me going. So I thank you for keeping me in your minds and hearts the way you have been. All right. So that's it for today. We'll see each other tomorrow. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.